You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. And this December, I'm sure you know, will mark the 100th anniversary, 100 years since the Wright brothers made their famous flight at Kitty Hawk. And we are marking that anniversary with a series of programs looking at the history of flight, the events leading up to that day in 1903, when the Wright brothers had the first demonstration of successful demonstration of powered flight. And we're looking at how the development of the airplane changed our world. And in this hour, a look at flight circa 1903. Who were the Wright brothers battling against in the race for the skies? What was it about their design, their work ethic, their thinking, their approach? Well, why were they successful and first were other people's people failed? Plus, what was the role of the military in shaping our centennial of flight before and after the Wrights? We'll also hear about some ways you can take part in the Centennial of Flight. There are a lot of books, a museum, exhibitions, exhibits, all kinds of stuff marking the event going on all during the year up to that day in December. And if you'd like to participate and talk to us with our guests, our number 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my guests. George Larson is editor of Air and Space Smithsonian Magazine. He joins us from our studios in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira.
Also joining us is James Tobin. He's a historian, a writer, and the winner of the National Book Critics Award for his book Ernie Pyle's War. His new book is To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight, published by Free Press. He joins us from WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. James, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
You know, one of the things that always amazes me about reading history, and I like to read history, is about the context of when these things happen. You know, I think like a vacuum, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. I think technology abhors a vacuum also in that there are a lot of other things going on. You know, 1903, you had Sam Langley along with the Wrights. You had Alexander Graham Bell, Langley's friends. All kinds of people were happening at that time.
There was, I think, a terrific sense that this was one of the last great technological feats to be performed, to fly. There was also great skepticism. People believed that it wouldn't be possible. But it is remarkable that the number of people around the world were all working on this problem at precisely the same time.
Mm-hmm. George Larson, Air and Space Magazine published a special issue looking back at 100 years of flight. The opening essay is called Miracle. And you say, as I'm sure James was talking about, it's not easy to persuade anyone in the year 2003 to look upon all that has happened as some kind of miracle. Why is that?
Well, I think when people come to the Air and Space Museum and see the Wright flyer at eye level, which is going to be possible this fall, you know, we're bringing it down from its place on the ceiling down to a special gallery. And when they look at that machine and go through the mental exercise of trying to be a person in 1903 who was asked to envision where this machine was going to go, you just don't see a 747 in there. You know, and that's the transformation from the original. Even the Wrights regarded it as a prototype. It's a marvelous thing to look at, just to look at it, the cloth and the sewing, and then go look at a riveted or bonded modern aircraft structure. The difference is striking.
Jim and George, I'll ask both of you, did they know anything about the science of flight, James? How you should design something so that it flies, the physics of it, anything like that?
Well, they were the ones who figured out the science of flight to the extent that it had been figured out. They picked up on experiments that the German glider pioneer Otto Lilienthal had done that had demonstrated something about the principles of lift. But then it was their own experiments with a wind tunnel that told them a great deal about how to maintain balance in the air. But that's still talking about sort of the technique of flight, the technology of flight. As far as the physics of flight, that remained a mystery for many years. The whole science of aerodynamics was something that that nobody knew very much about, and the Wrights were terrifically curious about that problem, but it was something that they intended to pursue after they had sort of come to practical perfection with the airplane.
James Tobin, what was it about this period in history that spurred all this kind of innovation? From reading James Tobin's book, he talks about the Wrights living in Dayton. He writes that in 1900, Dayton had more patents per capita. Dayton, Ohio had more patents per capita in that city than any other place in the U.S. It's amazing.
Dayton was a some people have said that this is Dayton was the Silicon Valley of the turn of the 20th century. There were a lot of machine shops in Dayton. Dayton was a center of the bicycle craze, so lots of people were thinking about machinery, talking about machinery, and it was very much the age of Thomas Edison. Edison was a great popular hero at the turn of the century. He had invented the phonograph, of course, and not only the light bulb, but the whole electrical system of lighting. And so the idea that you could divine these mysteries from nature and solve problems that had gone unsolved for centuries was very much in the air, and I think that appealed to Wilbur Wright very much and to many others at the time.
Mm-hmm. One point that you make in your book was that no one knew when the Wrights and Langley were at work. No one knew for sure that the laws of nature would allow man to fly, and that goes back to the question about the physics of it. Even Isaac Newton argues that the laws of nature would not permit man to fly. Is that why it was thought of such a miracle that you could get up in this plane?
Yeah, there was a sort of this long-standing argument against flight, going back to Newton, having to do with the problem of creating an engine that would be both powerful enough and yet light enough to keep a large flying machine off the ground. And Newton and others, contemporaries of the Wrights, actually, you know, argued that this would be physically impossible or at least highly difficult. So it was the sort of the standard of impossibility, Wilbur Wright once said. It was the way we think about perpetual motion or time travel today. It was the thing that you would point to and say, well, this of all things will not be possible. This is not within the grasp of man.
Why do you devote the first chapters of your book to Samuel Langley? Who was he? Why is he so important in this story?
Well, Langley was the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, a position that was somewhat more prominent than it is today, sort of the leading scientist in the United States. I started with Langley to emphasize the point that the Wrights were not alone. When we think of the Wrights, when we learn about the Wrights as elementary school kids, you know, it's in a very simplistic and superficial way. We think of them as these American icons operating in a vacuum. I wanted to show that many people were pursuing this, that the Wrights were underdogs in this pursuit. And Langley, I just kind of became fascinated by as I did research on him and studied his personality, his life, and his background. He was somebody obsessed with the idea of becoming one of the great figures in the history of science. He was an astronomer by training, quite an accomplished one, but came to think that he would not be remembered as a giant of science in astronomy. And so he sort of gingerly, reluctantly takes on the pursuit of this flying problem, which really put his reputation at some risk because most scientists considered this to be a crazy kind of thing to pursue.
And in fact, the Smithsonian did not recognize the Wright brothers as the first people to fly. Isn't that right, George Larson? It took like decades, 40 years or something like that.
Yeah, that is true. And it was something that really was there was a great deal of disagreement, and Orville Wright, who survived his brother, took the unusual step of having the original 1903 flyer sent over to England, where it remained for, I believe, until 1948 or so. And then they finally resolved their differences. But, the Smithsonian kind of was stubborn on that point.
Are they embarrassed by it now a little bit?
Oh, I think nobody's still working there who made those decisions, Ira. So, no, there's nobody embarrassed about what they did back then. But
I should
we're very glad to have the artifact.
Uh-huh.
The Smithsonian recognized that the Wrights had been the first to fly. The point of contention was who had designed the first airplane that was capable of flight. That was the Smithsonian's phrase for many years. It was argued that Langley's aerodrome, as it was called, was capable of flight, but that it had been messed up the experiments had been messed up in the takeoff phase. Now, it's been fairly convincingly demonstrated that Langley's airplane was not capable of flight, but that was what really bothered Orville Wright for all those years, was the Smithsonian's remaining contention that it was just a little glitch in the takeoff that had caused the problem.
Mm-hmm. It's fitting we take our first call from Ohio, Henry in Yellow Springs. Hi, Henry.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I'm interested in the engine of the plane and just a little bit of well, incident of history, there was one instance where a guy had a 4-ton steam engine that he was trying to get to take off many years, a couple decades before the Wright brothers. But on the engine, I work in restoration at the Air Force Museum in Dayton, and several of us are arguing over who designed the engine, whether it was Charles Taylor or the Wright brothers on the design of it. Anyone know?
I think it should be seen as a combination effort. Charles Taylor was the Wright's mechanic in their bicycle shop,
right.
Was a skilled machinist, and he was the one who did most of the physical work of constructing the machine.
Right.
And it is a little bit, I mean, I don't think anybody knows for sure precisely who made the designs, except that it was a kind of joint effort between the three of them.
Okay, yeah.
Now you can solve that argument. Hope you
well, now.
Hope you put a good bet down on that one for me. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. A lot of times in that era of invention, at the turn of the century, and I know this happened to be true with Bell and his telephone and whatever, a lot of times the inventor is not that skilled technically at making stuff, so he finds somebody who'll make the things for him that he draws. Was that true of the Wright brothers? Was one a better tinkerer and the other one a better thinker?
Well, it is sometimes said that Orville was the better engineer. I'm not at all convinced of that. Mm-hmm. I think that the Wrights are a good example of people who were gifted both theoretically and scientifically and mechanically. They were excellent at building things, but they were also brilliant amateur scientists. Samuel Langley is a perfect example of what you mentioned. He had to hire a young engineer just out of Cornell, Charles Manley, to do most of the actual work of putting his machines together.
Mm. What about the actual conceptualizing how to build the plane? Was Wilbur the guy who was better at saying, hey, you know, anybody can get something to fly, but I know the key to flight, and I know from reading your book, is that you have to know how to steer it and get it to go where you want to, right?
Yeah. I think you do have to credit Wilbur with that original conception of the problem. He, of the two brothers, he was the one who we know for sure became interested in the problem first. Within the family, it was really seen as Wilbur's flying machine for several years as they worked on it. Orville sort of tagged along and only gradually became a full partner. And it was Wilbur, by studying out what had been done before, by watching birds very carefully in and around Dayton, who came up with this basic concept of the problem itself to be solved. I mean, that was really the first key mm-hmm. step in the whole progress of the thing was figuring out that there were wings that were capable of lift that could be built. There were light enough engines to power the thing. The problem would be how to create a mechanism for controlling the aircraft and keeping it balanced once it got in the air. That would be the real definition of a successful flying machine.
Is that why they beat out Langley? They knew they had a different way of solving, or knew a key to solving those problems.
Well, I think that is very much the key. Langley, it's interesting, concentrated very much on this problem of the engine. Langley got trapped in this academic argument going all the way back to Newton about the question of could you build a light enough engine that would be powerful enough to keep this thing moving through the air. Langley understood the problems of balance and control, of getting up in the air and of coming down safely, would have to be solved eventually. He even glimpsed a little piece of the problem that Wilbur Wright saw and solved, which was how birds keep their balance by altering the angles of the tips of their wings, which was incorporated in the design of the airplane. But Langley never focused in on that and solved it. He saw that there was something in that action of the bird's wings that might give the answer, but he never followed through on it and got obsessed with this perfect engine. So I do think that that was very much a key to the Wright success, as was their eagerness, their willingness to get their hands dirty, to get inside the machines, starting with gliders, and actually fly the things. Their concept of a successful flying machine was not just the machine itself, but the machine plus the operator. They understood that it had to be this sort of delicate ballet between man and machine. And Langley was trying to invent a machine without any man trials whatsoever. And that was just doomed to failure. Mm.
Talking about the Wright brothers this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. When did let's take us a step further past the Wright brothers. They've now done their flight. Was this design immediately copied, or was it patented, or did people start to then copy their design and create their own airplanes? What happened following that?
Well, there's a complicated little set of things that happens. The Wrights were worried about people copying their designs. They were especially worried about a guy named Augustus Herring, who was a flight experimenter, who had shown himself to be pretty unsavory and at one point even tried to blackmail the Wrights into cooperating with him on a business venture. So they were worried about him, and so they began to experiment increasingly in private. Now, a friend of theirs and an encourager, one would say, a fellow named Octave Chanute, a very experienced Chicago engineer, had a lot of connections in France. He had been born in France and traveled to Europe often. He went to France in 1902, 1903, and had a lot of correspondence with the French aviators, and gave away more than the Wrights wanted him to. And so the French, who were very active in aviation and attempting to build flying machines, very quickly took what they knew about the Wrights' designs and tried to make their own machines along those lines. French aviation had been stalled up until that point, and the French were very, very sort of proud of their aviation efforts, were alarmed by the idea of these Americans overtaking them. And so as word of the Wrights sort of filters out, at first through Chanute, the French very quickly begin to imitate those designs. And then back in the U.S., Alexander Graham Bell, who was a close friend of Langley's, was working on his own designs, brought together a group of young engineers, chief among them Glenn Curtis, who also began to use the Wrights' designs. By that point, 1907, 1908, the Wrights' patent had been approved and published, and so there was more to work with in terms of their actual design and the devices that they were using.
Hmm. In fact, it was Orville and Kate, you write in your book, who blamed Glenn Curtis for Wilbur's death over all the legal battles and things like that he went through, patent fights.
Yeah, it's really a sad story. After sort of the end of Wilbur's flying career in 1909, when he has a wonderful kind of dramatic showdown with Glenn Curtis flying over New York Harbor, they were just getting into a legal battle, with the Wrights insisting that Curtis was using their designs without proper compensation. There were suits and countersuits, and Wilbur, who really wanted nothing more than to go back into the laboratory and continue his experiments, was forced to fight these legal battles against Curtis and others. The Wrights were always they were a pretty tough bunch, and they were angry at anyone who opposed them. And so when Wilbur died in 1912 in the midst of this legal battle of typhoid fever, Orville and their sister Catherine were pretty quick to say that it was Curtis who had forced this legal battle upon Wilbur, right, and that Wilbur had died as a result.
All right, we're going to come back and talk lots more about this fascinating history. So stay with us. We'll take your phone calls. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note on Monday's Talk of the Nation in this hour. Join Neil Conan for a look at choosing the best school for your child. That's on Monday's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking this hour about the 100th anniversary of flight at Kitty Hawk. My guests, George Larson, editor of Air and Space, Smithsonian Magazine; James Tobin, author of To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers, and The Great Race for Flight. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's get a few phone calls in here. Elaine in Minneapolis. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. My question is, at what point did airplane manufacturers or producers stop using the wing warping? I do understand that NASA is doing experiments, I believe, with the FA-18 currently with wing warping, and are able to do more with it now because of computer usage. But I was wondering, at what point did it stop, and if anybody knows about the experiments with NASA that NASA's doing.
Maybe George knows. George, any idea?
Sure. It really stopped with the Wrights because the airplanes in Europe and airplanes like the Curtis airplane immediately adopted the use of separate surfaces called ailerons that achieved pretty much the same effect as wing warping and were simpler mechanically. But you're quite right about the FA-18 bringing back the technique.
What
by
is it?
Actually,
tell us
bending
what
the wing.
What is it? You bend the wing so you can steer the plane that way?
Sure.
Twist
it's,
it?
It's, You twist the actual wing along its length, so that the wingtip out at the end is bent down or up more than it is at the root. It's actually twisted. That's true.
Good question, Elaine.
I did have a second question.
Sure.
Did the Wright brothers make much money on it? I mean, did they become what was considered wealthy? Or
filthy rich. I don't know. Or
did they just become comfortably off? Or?
They pay a lot of lawyers a lot of money to defend.
Yeah. Well, as I say, Wilbur died in 1912. Orville lived until 1948. Orville was not much inclined to be a manufacturer and a businessman, and so he sold out all of his interests in the relatively young Wright Company in 1915 for about $1.5 million, which, of course, in that day and age was a great deal more than $1.5 million would be today. So Orville lived the rest of his life retired, essentially. He was kind of the senior statesman of aviation in a big, beautiful house just outside of Dayton. But it was not the founding of, you know, a great family fortune like, say, the Ford family.
And so thanks for calling. What was the family that took over? Or where was the fortune made then following the Wright brothers?
Oh, well, the family tree of the company gets very complicated very quickly.
Well, I don't mean the Wrights themselves. Who came along and became the giant entrepreneur? Was it?
Well
Curtis Glenn
was
Martin
one of
was one.
Glenn Martin.
Glenn
right.
Martin was one, and Donald Douglas. There, the real entrepreneurs started to emerge between the wars.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of war, was there, in 1903, that was an incredible period in American history. We talk about all the inventors who were around, but we were also, the Spanish-American War had just been fought in Cuba. Was there a war influence now, realizing, hey, we're into fighting a modern war, perhaps these airplanes, the military should invest in this new technology?
The Spanish-American War actually played a critical role in all this story. And it was on the side of Samuel Langley. Langley had built successful, smaller, unmanned aerodromes that had flown over the Potomac River in 1895, 1896, and he was determined to try and build a manned flying machine, but he couldn't get the funding for it. Then, just on the eve of the Spanish-American War, it became clear that the U.S. War Department might be interested in a flying machine as a reconnaissance vehicle. And so Langley was able to get a substantial grant from the War Department to pursue that. It took him much longer to come up with an experimental machine than he had promised, but that was the original impetus for his experiments.
Mm-hmm. Well, then the famous planes we saw of World War I, the Sopwith Camel, the other ones, were they basically Wright flyers, or were they a different design?
I should defer to Mr. Larson on this.
The Wright Flyer is actually built backwards. I mean, and I say that with
that's
no
true,
disrespect.
When you look at it,
The horizontal tail surface is in the front, and what that does is to make the machine terribly unstable. It was a real handful to fly that thing, and the guys who are going to try it again in December are going to. They already know that it's going to be tough. But by moving the horizontal stabilizer to the back, the configuration of the airplane was set, and that's the way they're made today. There are some exceptions, and there's a so-called canard configuration that uses what the Wrights did. But by and large, 99.9% of the airplanes built today look kind of like the original Blériot, which was a French design that had a single wing, a monoplane, with wires and bracing, but it had its tail in the back.
The centennial edition of Air and Space, which came out in March, is that still available on newsstands?
It sold out.
It's such a great.
I'm glad
I
and sad
imagine.
To report.
Yeah, that because it we still have had another 9 months to go until December.
Well, we'll have a look forward 100 years in December. So don't give up.
Well,
we've got to take a look at the year 2103 and what we expect. We'll be celebrating at that time.
You're also promoting our next program, a third in our series. We're going to be looking forward to that. Maybe we'll be able to collaborate a little bit on that. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can go to the phones again. A lot of interesting questions. Hugh in Wheeler, Oregon. Hi, Hugh.
Hi,
how are you?
Great program. My question was this. I understand I'd heard or read that there was a fellow in New Zealand that had flown about 8 months before the Wrights did, and I was curious about that.
Well, these stories are becoming a minor hobby of mine, to collect these stories about people who predated the Wrights. There's a New Zealand story. There's a Texas story. There's a Scotland story. And the thing is, it's very difficult to sort of disprove these things because there isn't any direct evidence one way or the other. What we know for sure is that even if somebody else perhaps hopped off the ground for some distance and came back down, we know that what the Wrights did led directly to practical airplanes as we know them today.
Let me just stop you for a second and ask, was there a rule? You had to follow certain rules in order to be considered to be the first one to have flight. I mean, you had to fly a certain amount of time, a certain distance.
That's a great question. And the thing is that the definition of flight was absolutely in flux at the time. It was really only later that people looked back and said, "Well, what do we define as the first flight?" This business that we're celebrating on December 17th, the 12-second flight of 120 feet. Is remarkable sort of only in retrospect. It was really what the Wrights did 2 years later with a fully practical airplane, staying up for a couple of hours at a time and flying for many miles, that constitutes the first real working airplane. So it's a good question. The answer is no. There was absolutely no formal definition at all, and everybody was groping around to figure out, you know, what constituted flight in the first place.
And in fact, they kept it secret for years, didn't they? Their own flight in December.
Well, it's not that they kept it secret. They did. They did a press release the very day that they flew. Mm-hmm. But they realized quickly that because Langley had come in for so much scorn and ridicule because of his failure in trying to fly, they did not want to keep doing experiments that you know, some of which would work and some of which would fail. They didn't want that all exposed to press scrutiny. So I tend to say that they did not work in secrecy so much as they worked sort of in privacy. There were people who witnessed their flights around Dayton after the pioneering flights at Kitty Hawk, but the Wrights did not go out of their way to publicize them until they were sure that this thing could work every time.
Beverly in Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Well, I had wanted to weigh in on the same question. I just came back from Brazil a couple of weeks ago, and I mentioned that I live near the Wright Museum where the first flight took place, and they looked at me horrified because they were convinced that it occurred in Brazil.
Right.
So,
well, I know you had the author of the recent book on Alberto Santos Dumont on, and that's what the lady is talking
right.
about. Santos Dumont was a balloonist who was interested in aviation and made many of the first flights and the first successful dirigibles, the lighter-than-aircraft that could be steered. In Brazil, Santos Dumont was built up as a great Brazilian hero and the father of flight, largely by regimes that came later and were trying to enhance their own sort of status to their own claim to national status by building up the sense of Brazilian nationality. In fact, the only airplane that Santos Dumont got off the ground anywhere near the time of the Wrights was a very clunky box kite-like contraption that barely got off the ground and was very dangerous and uncontrollable. But it is true. I've had people come up to me and say that they're Brazilians, and a lady said to me once, I'm buying this book for my brother back in Brazil, but we're going to try to tell not to tell anybody that he's actually reading it, because everyone in Brazil knows that Alberto Santos Dumont invented the airplane.
That's exactly right. Also, I understand that they've made a model of the Wright brothers' plane. Are they planning on trying to fly that yet this year, or has that already occurred?
Before I get the answer, just a quick reminder that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato, talking about the Wright brothers. They're going to fly. There is one in the Smithsonian, we know, right, George?
Yeah, that's not going to fly ever again.
That was the original
there
one.
To be studied, yeah. Right? But the reproduction has been fabricated by Ken Hyde in Warrenton, Virginia, and that will fly again. They will attempt to fly it. I mean, it's also going to depend on the weather that day, but they're going to try to fly it in December down at Kitty Hawk.
There are celebrations and exhibits all around the country now, right, commemorating this year.
That's right. And if you go on www.centennialofflight.gov, you can get a complete calendar of those.
How was it decided whether Wilbur or Orville was at the controls that day? Did they flip a coin? Or
They did flip a coin. They were ready for the first trial actually on December 14th, and Wilbur won the toss. And so he made the very first trial, and it was a brand new machine for them, and they weren't used to the controls, and he flubbed the elevator and came down after just a few feet, and the machine was a little bit damaged. So it took them a couple of days to fix it up, and on December 17th, the weather was right, and it was Orville's turn.
And was Wilbur jealous of, you know, bad luck?
I would have been. Although Wilbur had the consolation of flying much farther that day. There were four flights that day. First Orville, then Wilbur, then Orville again. And then in the fourth flight, Wilbur made the longest flight of the day, 852 feet, 59 seconds. And that was really the flight that convinced them that this thing had worked. And the machine actually was flipped over in a gust of wind just a short while after the fourth flight and was pretty wrecked. They had to put it back together years later. So that was the only day on which that flyer flew.
Just got about another minute. What were the brothers like? Were they equal, the same, or were they opposites in personalities? How would you describe
people, them? Well, people outside the family sometimes thought that they seemed remarkably similar if they spoke in conversation. They looked a little bit alike if you take away Orville's mustache. Their voices sounded the same. But Wilbur was the one who really had the drive and I think the genius. I don't think Orville would have taken up this project on his own, let alone brought it to success. Wilbur was tremendously impressive. He would go into a room of skeptical people and talk about the project, and it's funny how one account after another you see people say, after I spoke to this man, I was convinced that he had done all that he said he had done.
And George, is the Wright Flyer now on the floor at the Smithsonian, available for...
It's about to be moved, and in October the new gallery will open up, and it's really quite spectacular. There's an authentic, you know, detailed reproduction of what the Wright's front porch looked like off to one side. It's going to be an awful lot of fun.
Well, how are you going to handle the crowd to come see this thing? Wow. You can't touch it, right?
No, you can't touch it. It's protected. But, sure. But you can get awfully close, and we've never been able to offer that to folks before. It's been hanging about 20 feet up off the floor. So,
and you'll
see those.
And you say when you see it that close up, it really is a miraculous-looking thing. This could have flown.
Yeah, it really is. It really is a transforming experience to see it up close.
All right, we've run out of time. You'll have to just go to the Smithsonian in October and take a look for yourself. George Larson is the editor of Air and Space Smithsonian Magazine. James Tobin is a historian and writer. His new book, To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight, published by Free Press. Thank you both for joining us this hour. Kevin,
thanks very much.
You're welcome. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York, Peggy Watson in Ann Arbor. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and if you'd like to write us, please surf over to our website at Science Friday. Any of the links we talked about today, you've missed that link to go to the Smithsonian page, it's right up there. You just have to go to Science Friday. Science Friday's Kids Connection is also there with free curricula we make. Also, you can have past editions of Science Friday. You can listen to them on Real Audio. You can subscribe and download them on your audible.com player and take them with you for later enjoyment. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.